Welcome to Most Holy Family Monastery's radio program for this Friday evening. We're going to cover some different issues tonight. And also, if you haven't seen the Heresy of the Week column, going to cover a few of those just recently this week. The Vatican announced that it has no plans to convert Russia to the Catholic faith. Another amazing heresy, which proves, again, what we've been saying. Recently, Benedict XVI praised the Assisi prayer meeting of John Paul II, yet once again praising John Paul II's interreligious prayer meeting with different religions. He mentions, this is an Angelus address, June 17, 2007. He says, quote, from this city of peace, I would like to send a greeting to the representatives of other Christian denominations and other religions who in 1986 accepted the invitation of my venerable predecessor to take part in a world day of prayer for peace here in the homeland of St. Francis. So, again, it just shows that he completely endorses John Paul II's prayer meeting with different religions, where, of course, he allowed the promotion of every different false religion that almost has ever been created by the devil to be promoted in Assisi. And then we also have Benedict XVI, Bishops' Conference, May 24, 2007, where he says, quote, esteem and respect for all other religions and cultures are particularly necessary today, he says. So, he can throw out as many conservative statements as he wants. This shows you the true nature and who you're really dealing with here, a complete apostate.
And we're going to be talking about that a little later when we discuss Benedict XVI's recent book, Jesus of Nazareth, which really has a lot of very interesting things in it. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But readers of our website know that about a week or two ago, we posted a new article on geocentrism and how it relates to the Baptism of Desire issue. If you haven't read that article, it's a very important article because it gets into detail about many of the issues which come up with those who are debating on this important topic of salvation. And what it really proves is that the leading defenders of Baptism of Desire, who have consistently repeated that Baptism of Desire is a teaching of the Church, because many theologians, especially in the last few hundred years, adopted this position, because certain members of the Holy Office in 1949 condemned Father Feeney for rejecting it and for teaching the no exceptions position on outside the Church there's no salvation, and because a doctor of the Church such as St. Alphonsus Liguori considered Baptism of Desire de fide, they said this absolutely proves that Baptism of Desire is the teaching of the Catholic Church. And this article goes through and demonstrates in detail that all of those arguments are refuted by a careful consideration of the topic of geocentrism, and it shows how someone, a doctor of the Church such as St. Robert Bellarmine, who considered geocentrism to be de fide, was contradicted by later popes such as Pope Benedict XV in his 1921 encyclical In Preclara, which absolutely devastates the arguments of leading Baptism of Desire advocates. So we refer those who have not looked at that to that article. But right now I think we're going to talk a little bit about Benedict XVI's recent book, Jesus of Nazareth. It's a very interesting book. It's actually, by Benedict XVI's standards, quite conservative. And there are a lot of very conservative passages in it, but there are also heretical passages in it, as usual. And I just wanted to go through some of these here. I was going to turn to page 30 of this book, Jesus of Nazareth, where Benedict XVI's talking about how people want miracles, how people want miracles to be able to believe in certain things. And he's making reference to how people challenged our Lord. And he says, Christ is being challenged to establish his credibility by offering evidence for his claims. This demand for proof is a constantly recurring theme in the story of Jesus' life. Again and again he is reproached for having failed to prove himself sufficiently, for having hitherto failed to work that great miracle that will remove all ambiguity and every contradiction, so as to make it indisputably clear for everyone who and what he is or is not. So he says that our Lord is reproached repeatedly for having, quote, failed to prove himself sufficiently, for having failed hitherto to work that great miracle that will remove all ambiguity, so as to make it indisputably clear who he is. Well, our Lord did that over and over again. In fact, one of the errors of the modernists condemned by Pope St. Pius X in Lamentabili is that his miracles did not prove his messianic dignity. But here we have Benedict XVI essentially stating that he was reproached for having failed to work that miracle, as if he never worked it. Dismissing John chapter 11, where he raises Lazarus from the dead, and so many others. So this is quite an interesting statement, and I believe a heretical one. There are others. On page 33, just three pages later, he talks about indigenous religions and indigenous religious structures, meaning the structures in pagan countries set up to promote these different religions. And he says, the aid offered by the West to developing countries has been purely technically and materially based, and has not left God out of the picture. This aid, proudly claiming to know better, is in itself what first turned the Third World into what we mean today by that term. It has thrust aside indigenous religious, ethical, and social structures, and filled the resulting vacuum with its technocratic mindset. The idea was that we could turn stones into bread. Instead, our, quote, aid has only given stones in place of bread. The issue is the primacy of God. So he's criticizing the displacement of these pagan religious structures, obviously implying that these false religions, which in many cases worship devils, according to the scriptural teaching about false gods, that they're somehow good, and that they somehow should have been left in place, and that it's a tragic loss that they've been displaced. He talks about, on, if we move to page 66, he talks about the old law in this book. And he says, he talks about a renewed Israel, meaning the church, which does not exclude or revoke the old one, but steps beyond it into the domain of universality. So he's saying that the old Israel is not revoked. The old notion of Israel, that the Jews are the chosen people of God, etc., is not revoked. That's on page 66. That implies the heresy that the old covenant is still in force. On page 99, he refers to Mother Teresa as a saint, and I just wanted to quote that. The saints, from Paul through Francis of Assisi down to Mother Teresa, have lived out this option and have thereby shown us the correct image of man and his happiness. So Mother Teresa, who considered all religions good, who said she didn't want to convert people to Catholicism.
Yes, it said, actually, all I love all religions, and praise the Assisi prayer meeting that John Paul II held, the first one, as the, quote, most beautiful gift of God. So
she's a saint and moving toward canonization in the counter church. And this demonstrates that all of the conservative statements, as he was saying earlier, that Benedict XVI makes, and I think you were saying that the last few months, Benedict XVI has been more conservative in his statements, whereas in the winter and in the fall of last year, he was just on a rampage of heresy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And so he goes through these stages where he'll do things like go to a mosque, and he'll meet with the schismatic leaders, go to numerous schismatic churches. He'll make all kinds of outrageous statements, one after the other. Then he'll quiet down for a few months and seem conservative and you know, not make very many really outrageously heretical statements, and then he'll switch it back. That's how he does it. And actually, what's interesting about this book is I'm pulling out some of the more interesting things which I found to be offensive to Catholic teaching. But on the whole, this is quite a conservative book, and there are very many interesting things in it which actually illuminate a lot of points of Catholic teaching and the divinity of Christ and how One cannot read the New Testament and what our Lord does without seeing that he is God. And very interesting points. And you can see how someone who does not have a firm faith and is not convinced that Benedict XVI is a heretic is not rooted in the fact that a person who says and does these things, as Benedict XVI does, and who has said and done these things, cannot be in the church no matter how many other conservative statements he offers people. A person who does not have that conviction, who's weak of faith, could be led astray by reading this. They say, well, he seems so conservative. He seems so devout in many of these passages.
And we can see actually that demonstrated by over up in Spokane, Washington, where you had a number of nuns up there that left the convent.
I think it was like over 20. Maybe.
Over 20. And that actually demonstrates, because the CMRI's position is that you didn't have to hold the position that Benedict XVI was a heretic and therefore not pope. They actually admitted people into their community, at least the female religious community. They allowed people to come in and not hold the correct position that this guy, Benedict XVI, is a manifest heretic and therefore not pope. And, of course, this all leads to, this happening. And
they also allow them to teach, not only be a part of the community, but these people who believed that Benedict XVI is the pope and may have even believed that the new mass is valid. They allowed them, and Vatican II, to be a true council. They allowed them to teach in their schools. I mean, it's just ridiculous, and it shows their weakness. And also these women, I spoke to one nun who I asked from the CMR whether she believes Jews can be saved. Yes. And so you can see how a person like that, who really doesn't have any real faith, sad to say, in the Catholic dogmas, could be easily swept away by conservative statements that Benedict XVI has made. And even, you know, as this thing goes on, how hard it is for them to believe that, you know, this is another anti-pope. Is he really evil when he says all these things? So it's very interesting. And what's interesting is, in this book, he also quotes from a Jewish rabbi extensively. And one of the things that Benedict XVI does in his books is he'll quote at length from utter heretics and modernists. And now it's one thing to quote them, to try to expose them, to try to refute them, to try to show where they're denying Catholic teaching, or even on occasion, if they make a good point, to try to illustrate a point. But one of his styles of misleading people is a quote from these apostates all the time, page after page after page. So basically, after reading this, one is, unless you're really paying attention, you're wondering, is this what he believes or is this what this person believes? But the way he justifies himself is he's just quoting this other person. Well, why would a person who believes in Catholic teaching consistently and repeatedly and at length offer people the thoughts and the theology of modernists, apostates, heretics?
Yeah, allowing these false ideas to be disseminated in this widely publicized book.
Yeah, and in this one, maybe it's not the most egregious example, but in these other books, I mean, it's common. He's constantly quoting from the most radical heretics, giving us what they think about this, how they don't believe the gospel is authentic, and this and that, page after page of it. And so it's very revealing about how he wants to call into doubt and inculcate this unbelief in a subtle way. And so he quotes, and this is something that, you know, the mainstream press picked up on, that he quoted from this rabbi, Jacob Neusner, A Rabbi Talks with Jesus. He wrote a book. And one of the interesting things is the points that this rabbi makes, which he quotes from, is how the rabbi explains how one of his problems, or his main problem with accepting Christ, is that he cannot read the words of Jesus without concluding that he is God. And the rabbi points out that how Jesus says things that would require him to consider fidelity to Jesus and following Jesus more important than following the old law. And like he quotes some of the passages, such as Matthew 19:21, where our Lord says, "If you would be perfect, go sell all of what you have and come and follow me." And Neusner, the rabbi, points out how this just is a problem for him unless he were to accept Jesus as God, because it would make it seem that Jesus is more important than the God of the Old Testament, or what the regulations that the God of the Old Testament has set up. And so what it really shows is how the gospel is centered on accepting Christ, how Christ's words clearly prove that he is God, how you cannot read the New Testament without accepting him as God. But it would, what it also shows is that Benedict XVI's fascinated with the topic of who Jesus is. And that's something we've pointed out in the past, how John Paul II dissolved Christ, which is one of the definitions for Antichrist, by teaching that everyone is essentially Christ. And Benedict XVI has called into question in a number of his books whether Jesus is the Messiah. He says the Jewish view that he's not the Messiah is a valid one. And so he's really focused on that in a lot of this book. Who Jesus is, what does it mean to be the Son of God? Is he the Son of God? Those things. And it's interesting, in the end of the book, the very last page of the book, he basically calls it into question because, and maybe I'll get to that as we go along, but I just found that interesting, that some of the things the rabbi was saying, how, well, for instance, the rabbi makes reference to how our Lord says the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. And he says that he's putting himself above the laws of the Sabbath in the Old Testament. And therefore, he's centering everything on Jesus, and this is what he cannot accept. And it really shows how they just cannot accept Jesus as the Son of God in their unfortunate blindness. So I found that interesting. But he quotes at length from Neusner, never saying once that his denial of Christ or his failure to accept Christ is of bad will or is because he's not accepting the truth. He just gives his own ideas. He also makes a statement like this, which is interesting. On page 112, in the midst of this discussion, he says, at this point, the question arises for the Christian. Was it a good idea to jeopardize the great social function of the Sabbath, to break up Israel's sacred order for the sake of a community of disciples that is defined, as it were, solely in terms of the figure of Jesus? So he's saying, was it a good idea for Jesus to say things like, the Son of Man is the Lord also of the Sabbath, which would break up the social function of the Sabbath the way it was in the Old Testament? Was this a good idea, Benedict XVI asks. Of course it was a good idea. He was God. That would be the obvious answer. But Benedict XVI says, this question could and can be clarified only within the emergent community of disciples, the Church. We cannot enter into this discussion here. So he leaves it as an open question, as if it might not have been a good idea for Jesus to set up a community of disciples centered around him, which breaks up the social function and establishment of the Old Testament and how it was centered around the Sabbath. So that's again an example, and we've shown in other books how he does this. He'll ask questions like that. You know, is it true? I cannot answer that question here. When he's talking about something that is a defined teaching, is an obvious truth of the faith, and there's no question about it. And that's a heresy, because he's calling into doubt something that you must believe. And there are many other heresies in this book. We could look at page 229. Just want to turn to that. Where he makes a curious statement about the gospel. He says, if historical is understood to mean that the discourses of Jesus transmitted to us have to be something like a recorded transcript in order to be acknowledged as historically authentic, then the discourses of John's gospel are not historical. That's what he says. That, to me, seems to indicate that the discourses of John's gospel may not be historically accurate. Because he says if historical is understood to mean that they have to be like a recorded transcript, well, I mean, they are a record of what Jesus said. So that is at least smacking of heresy, probably heretical. There are other statements in the book that could be mentioned, but those are just some of them. Now I'll turn to maybe the last page. And it's interesting because near the end of the book, he starts to get into what the definitions are for Son of Man, Son, and Son of God. Excuse me. And he makes some good points about that Son of God indicates equal to God, that when the apostles described our Lord as the Son of God, that was to say that he is equal with God. But he also says things that are questionable, which may imply that, you know, it's fuzzy. It's not clear what is meant by the Son and the Son of God and the Son of Man, that he's sort of calling it into question, and it's somewhat confusing. But in the last page of the book, page 355, he talks about the First Council of Nicaea, which declared that our Lord was consubstantial with the Father of the same substance. And he says, for this purpose, the First Council of Nicaea, 325, adopted the word consubstantial. This term did not Hellenize the faith or burden it with an alien philosophy. On the contrary, it captured in a stable formula exactly what had emerged as incomparably new and different in Jesus' way of speaking with the Father. So he says that consubstantial captures what is new about Jesus' way of speaking with the Father. In other words, he just had a special way of speaking with the Father. Not that he's God, not that he's of the same substance with the Father, but this term captures his special way of speaking with the Father, calling into doubt that he is really God. So that's a very curious statement to make at the very end of his book, and I think it lends credence to what we're saying about how he's calling into question who Jesus is, as he has in his other books. So, but it all, by his standards, this is actually quite a conservative book. I mean, even though there are some things, as we mentioned, it's much more conservative. You can see how it would deceive these people who unfortunately don't love the truth, who are not convinced, who don't really believe that the church is supernatural, and therefore that if a person becomes a heretic, that he removes himself automatically from the church, you know, ipso facto, and that he can say this or that, but if he would never do these other things if he weren't very evil. And so you can see that he's probably the false prophet, possibly.
And also people should see that if he's doing these things, these so-called, you know, these conservative statements that he's putting out sometimes, and at the same time embracing, promoting, esteeming different false religions, that a person's got to think deeply about, you know, those kinds of questions there. If he's making some conservative statements that we've got to do this, we've got to do that to be Catholic or whatever, and at the same time embracing, endorsing, and promoting false religions that reject the Catholic faith and Jesus Christ altogether, then none of these issues matter. It doesn't matter what you would believe if you claim to be a Catholic, because we're all going to heaven according to him. He esteems religions that reject the Catholic faith and Jesus Christ altogether. So all these conservative statements absolutely mean nothing to him. That you would have to, a person who has any goodwill in him has to see that this is a fraud. That even if he throws out some conservative statements, his endorsement of false religions proves that in Benedict XVI's view, it all means nothing. And it's just amazing the scandals that we have going on. Some of the people who take a look at the news and commentary section on the website, the Vatican was actually going to not attend a Holocaust memorial, and because they actually have listed actually a picture of Pius XII, actually at the Holocaust memorial, where they say, quote, even when reports about the murder of Jews reached the Vatican, the Pope did not protest, end quote. And which is not true, by the way. You had Pius XII taking all kinds of aggressive and proactive measures and actions to try to save Jews' physical lives, you know, them from being killed and hiding them away in different convents and monasteries, printing up false baptismal records, which I don't agree with. We don't agree with that action. And at the same time, also, Catholics are being slaughtered in Russia and Eastern Europe. And you can see what happens, that he still gets blamed for not doing enough. And so anyway, what happened was the Vatican, I guess because the Jews were upset that no one was going to come for this conference, they said, okay, yeah, we'll send a representative. And so the Vatican's ambassador to Israel attended the Holocaust Memorial on a Sunday, and it's just amazing. So this is pretty far down for those who haven't taken a look in a little while. Some just other quick points. In the Portland diocese, it cost them $75 million to get out of bankruptcy. Yet another, quote, Catholic university holds pro-gay conference. Then we have also an actual, quote, gay mass that was broadcast from San Francisco. I think that was carried by the BBC, I believe. And so we have hospitals that claim to be Catholic. I believe they claim to be Catholic. Yes. Removing crucifixes from the hospital rooms to please Muslims and replacing it with something else, which is a denial of the faith. Spokane, Washington, Novus Ordo Diocese only asked the people for $10 million to pay for abuse lawsuits. And then we have also some other interesting things. The pro-abortion politician Nancy Pelosi was honored at a, quote, Catholic university. And
drunken priest drives car into restaurant.
Yeah, another one. And then we have also Bank 16th reinstating the Islam department. Cleveland, Ohio diocese closes 23 parishes.
But yet, if he's going to give back the Latin Mass, people just, you know, can't wait. You know, one, they're ready to give in immediately.
In Ireland, you had the Novus Ordo Church, who appointed the first openly non-Catholic to a senior post up there. And more Novus Ordo churches will be leveled, merged with others. Just a very interesting things that are happening, you know, in the news and commentary. You can take a look at that. So, and actually, one of the other things that just happened was this, quote, Catholic parish actually built a Protestant church. And then we have in Oakland, California, the Novus Ordo Vatican II Church building a $190 million Cathedral of Light. $190 million for just completely empty,
false worship,
vapid, worthless church, which nothing will be present there except the devil.
Did you want to read that quote about upside-down crosses?
Actually, as some people know, one of the things that a lot of people have protested is the fact that we made major note of the fact that John Paul II, I believe it was March 24th, 2000, in Israel, he sat in front of about 100,000 people, sitting in a gigantic chair with a huge upside-down cross cut into the chair. That's the only thing on the chair. Was the chair was actually designed with a huge cutout of an upside-down cross that was right over his head. And a lot of people said, oh, yeah, that was for St. Peter's crucifixion, which it was not, of course, not done on the day that St. Peter was crucified. Nothing was mentioned about St. Peter's crucifixion.
It wasn't any one of St. Peter's feast days.
Yeah, and the church, yeah, just doesn't use this commonly. Outside, there's an altar that has a small upside-down cross
in Rome.
That's it. The church never uses it. And so it's a symbol synonymous with Satanism. And to prove that, a lot of these people love Malachi Martin. And in his book, The Final Conclave, on page 7, he says this, quote, "The classical sign of Satan, the upside-down cross." There you go. So these people who love Malachi Martin, obviously someone a lot of people consider an expert on witchcraft, Satanism, and so forth, he says it's the classical sign.
And so the bad will of these people who have actually made a big deal out of this, who have tried to say it's just ridiculous to criticize John Paul II for appearing in public with a gigantic upside-down cross over his head. I mean, these people are just ridiculous. And that's the question I always ask them. Would they put an upside-down cross on their front door? And, of course, they wouldn't.
Yeah, I guess everyone would know, according to them, that when they see the upside-down cross, yep, that means St. Peter's crucifixion. That would immediately click for these other people when they saw the upside down cross. I mean, it's just
ridiculous,
amazing. And one of the other interesting things that actually happened recently, since our last broadcast, I believe, was we were in contact with a young man from the Baltimore, Maryland area, who called and said that he's having trouble with the devil and the devil's stopping him from praying. And we told him, you know, you have to continue to pray and the devil can't stop you from praying. And he said, no, you don't understand my situation. Like, he had some special situation that he just couldn't pray because basically worshiping the devil.
He also said he had no free will.
No free will.
And I asked him, well, how did you make this phone call? And he had to acknowledge that he made it through his own free will. But he basically was saying that there was this, basically the devil was outside of him, basically living on him as a liquid, and he wouldn't allow him to do anything. And when we pointed out to him, obviously he had free will to do certain things, that he's giving too much credit to the devil. And one of the interesting points that ties in with this is that one of the frequent ways one comes across that people sometimes get more and more involved with demonic activity is by giving too much credit to the devil and looking in too much to these experiences they're undergoing. Did you want to tell the story of that one guy who claimed to be seeing certain demons, and as he basically let that focus his whole day? You know,
there's one guy actually who I know who would constantly like listen. You know, he said they talk to me all day long, and see, if you really start to think about that and think that, yeah, I've got some special case where the devil's talking to me, and you give into that, then you're going into the devil's world, and God will allow you to sort of, you know, just sort of almost fall away from the faith, because your whole day is that I've got this special situation, the devil's talking to me, I'm temporarily possessed, and they're going to do this to me, they threaten me with this, they threaten me with that. And
this problem grew and grew.
Yeah, it grew and grew, and people tried to help him. Then all of a sudden he would burst out saying, I think maybe you're under the control of the devil. And it can be a very subtle form of pride. And actually, because the person says, you know, these people, they don't have my experience, and I have this special kind of thing where the demons are talking to me. And
there's an interesting case that ties into that is we knew a guy from San Francisco who was hearing these voices and so on, and I told him to simply ignore them. And he didn't listen, and sometime later he called back telling me that he was the Pope, that one of these voices had told him that he was the Pope and that we would be excommunicated for not submitting to him. And he obviously had been given over to more of the devil by not taking the sound advice, which was to ignore these demonic voices. And what's interesting is after that point, he continued to have this problem hearing these voices. And I told him again, ignore them. Okay. And he finally did. And they went away completely. And he didn't have any problem with it when he ignored them. But when he gave them too much credit, started to really listen to them, let them become the focus, then he was basically given over by God. And what's interesting is with this young man from Baltimore, that's what we told him. To simply ignore it, don't give the devil too much credit.
Yeah, we actually had to hang up the phone on him and just said, the guy won't listen. You know, he's just basically worshiping the devil, and he would not listen. He just felt like, yeah, I know what's going on. You don't understand. So I said, well, okay.
And so we hadn't heard from him for a few years. But then about 3 weeks ago?
Yeah. Yeah. You spoke to him, so.
Yeah, well, actually, his mother called up, who's not a Catholic. We hadn't heard from him in years. And she called up, explained to us that her son was basically screaming like a possessed person. I could hear him in the background. She put it on speakerphone. He was saying that I'm quoting him, I am Antichrist, I am possessed. And in the midst of that, he would say things that were logical and coherent, but then he would go out in this rage. You can hear him screaming. She said he's up in the middle of the night. Neighbors hear him. And so his problem just got much worse over time because he continued to think essentially that the devil could not be overcome. And when the devil cannot do anything that God doesn't allow him to do, he can only do what God allows him to do.
And so God just turned him over to Satan. Actually, we just actually heard from another person who we know, whose mother doesn't practice the faith and has had a lot of years looking at this maybe information and just doesn't do anything, just doesn't seem to care. And then he called us and said, my mom's, you know, like screaming like she's possessed and totally changed. All of a sudden, from being a normal, reasonable person in a lot of ways, just screaming like a possessed person. It's just really amazing what can happen when people allow themselves to be controlled and don't care about the faith. People play around with God, and God can let you be turned over to Satan, as we can see happening a lot of times. Some other quick things, actually, a news article that we saw a link to and so forth actually had go-go dancers at this Novus Ordo so-called liturgy. It's just absolutely amazing almost, although almost nothing shocking now. The lady's dancing around and totally immodest. I don't think we probably could even link to it because it's just so. And this guy's offering his Novus Ordo Mass right in front of this. This girl's doing her dance. It's just amazing. It's amazing that people wouldn't immediately walk out, but yet people stay for that. A lot of people like that. It just shows you the level of diabolical activity, the level of control Satan has over people, the general liberalism that we're dealing with. People just don't care. They go there for entertainment. They don't care. And one other point was, and probably have hopefully more information on this in the near future, Benedict XVI met with some mufti or Islamic guy, and he met with a rabbi. And the rabbi asked for a blessing from Benedict XVI, and Benedict XVI blessed the rabbi. And then the rabbi asked him, "Can I bless you?" And Benedict XVI said, "Yes, you can bless me." And so the rabbi then blessed Benedict XVI, another act of complete apostasy.
And one point that ties in with what you were saying about how the diabolical activity and the blindness at these Novus Ordo churches, we got a call from a guy yesterday or 2 days ago who received someone, you know, handed him a DVD at his Novus Ordo church there, I guess, you know, as a way of evangelizing. And he watched it. It was The Amazing Heresies of Paul VI. And he called it scandalous, divisive, false. And I started asking him a few questions. I said, "Do you accept outside the church no salvation?" I explained to him that it was a dogma defined by the church. He said, "No, I reject it." And 300 million other, quote, Catholics, he said, rejected as well. And I said, "Well, what do you think about what Jesus said in the gospel that most people are lost?" And he said he believes that all men go to heaven, doesn't believe that anyone goes to hell. And this is a guy who wanted us to report us to his Novus Ordo bishop. He thinks he's a faithful Catholic, believes that all men go to heaven.
Yeah, so he shouldn't care what we're doing.
Yeah, so I said, "Why do you even care?" And he was just so angry at the material. And it's just amazing how not...
And you see the effort that some people will put out to stop the truth. Like, they don't care about anything else, but if you send them something that has truth in it, then people start to get aggressive, proactive. They make phone calls. They'll put out some effort because they're of the devil.
Oh, yeah. It's like there was, I think, maybe a year and a half ago, a national list you could register for, a do-not-call list by these telemarketers. They call people up, and people can get on this list saying, you know, if you don't want to be called, register on this list. And it's amazing the effort that these people would put out just because they don't want to get a phone call during the day from one of these telemarketers. But they don't care about investigating the true religion. You know, they'll put out all kinds of effort to make sure they don't get bothered by a little phone call during the day. But about the important things, yeah, they don't care.
Yeah, some people that have actually received our mailing either from someone else who wanted to send them the information or they got a free copy of something. You know, you have some people that actually will call up and say, "How'd you get my name?" you know, I never want to be on your mailing list. You know, how, and they, I mean, the aggressiveness that you see that these people put out because they don't want to be bothered by the truth as they live their pagan lives, living their lives on the broad road that leads to damnation.
Another interesting note is we're now selling the book Denzinger, which is a good book. It's available at our store on our website. We had sold it some time back, but we hadn't sold it for a while, but we do sell it. And for people who want to have an English version of some of the more important and prominent pronouncements in church history from councils, et cetera, that's a good book to have. And not everything in it is infallible because it contains statements from regional councils, which are not infallible, and papal statements, which would not meet the levels of infallible pronouncements. It's a collection of historical documents pertaining to the church. For instance, the two letters of Pope Honorius to Sergius, which were actually heretical, are in Denzinger. But it's a good book to have for people who want to research more or see an example of where we're getting or quoting a lot of things from. That's one book to have, so it's available on at our store. And relating to the demonic possession that we were talking about earlier, one thing that's interesting that I found quite striking is that when you start to read more about some of these cases, that one of the most common ways that people become possessed is through having been cursed. And I found that very interesting and somewhat puzzling at first. But after thinking about it more, it really makes sense because it shows that, and we actually made this point on the e-exchange, but that God emphasizes, our Lord emphasizes, that if you pray, you will receive things. If you ask Him, and if you ask Our Lady, if you ask His saints, you will receive things. You know, you will receive graces and so forth. And so God allows the devil to do the same thing in certain cases for those who have given themselves to Him or put themselves in His kingdom through mortal sin, that if they ask the devil to curse someone, he sometimes will be allowed to do so by God because they've invoked the devil and asked the devil. And obviously it could only take effect over someone who's already in the devil's kingdom by mortal sin, which is another reason why it's such a horrible evil. But I found it very interesting that that's really a common case. And even that Novus Ordo exorcist, Father Gabriel Amorth, he actually said the same thing. He said that one of the most common ways that people become possessed in his experience that he's seen is through having been cursed. So it shows the, you know, intercessory aspect of the whole supernatural world. That so it's somewhat interesting.
Maybe also some of the questions that, again, we've covered this before, this lady Stella Cooper asking about that the consecration of Russia has to be done with all the bishops. And
yeah, and we emphasize that Our Lady requested that it be done with all the bishops, but she only promised that in the end the Holy Father himself will do it. She said the Holy Father will consecrate Russia. It's also clear from our Lord and our Lady that the actual fulfillment of the consecration will not be as it was originally requested. It will be late, says our Lord. It will only result in a, quote, certain period of peace. But when she said what would occur if it was done precisely, she said it would be a period of peace. She didn't add certain. So that indicates that what will finally happen in the end will not be exactly what she would have given if her request had been heeded precisely. And someone else, actually, another traditionalist writer, had actually written something recently on, after we had posted this on our own website, reemphasizing these points, that he doesn't really believe that conversion can mean that, and, you know, he finds it almost blasphemous. But it's just ridiculous when you actually look carefully at the context of the request. The context of the message, Our Lady says, she asked for the consecration in the context of preventing wars, okay, famines, okay, the spread of the heirs of Russia. She asks in that specific context so that the fulfillment of the promise that would come when the consecration is done pertains to those specific things mentioned. It doesn't pertain to conversion of the nation to the Catholic faith. So that's something worth mentioning. One other interesting point is We posted it on our e-exchange sometime back, but it's about this saint, Saint Francis Solanas. He's a little known Spanish saint. He was a great apostle to South America, and he's very little known, but he's arguably the most extraordinary apostle ever to set foot on the American continent. And he converted or baptized, some say as many as like 100,000 people, but definitely thousands in South America. And he was actually a very miraculous saint. He lived in the 16th century, and a lot of interesting miracles in his life as he was, you know, preaching the faith to these heathens in South America in really wild areas, you know, very desolate wilderness and, you know, unexplored region, like all of the interior of South America at that time had not been explored. It was quite remote. And there was one case where he came across a river, and he basically didn't know how to cross, and he was trying to move on to some other peoples. And the river was wide, and there was no boat to carry him to the opposite shore. How happy were his Indians in their belief that they would have their padre with them a little longer. But he, it seems, was hearing the voices which cried to him from the other side. There were people on the other side waiting for him. For the last time, he exhorted his dear Indios to persevere in seeking God's grace in the faith and in the love of neighbor, and he gave them his blessing. Then, lifting up his eyes to heaven, he was elevated to ecstasy. He now spread his mantle upon the water and embarked upon it without fear, and thus passed over to the opposite shore, leaving those who had accompanied him as far as the river in the extreme of astonishment. It's one of his most extraordinary miracles. So he basically crossed miraculously on his mantle the river, and there are a lot of others, but he was quite an extraordinary saint. We also post that interesting point relating to the baptism issue, because when he was traveling over on his ship, a huge hurricane basically came across the ship and threatened to destroy the whole ship. And he had started, as this hurricane grew worse and worse, instructing some of these non-Catholics, these unbelievers, in the faith. And he had started to tell them things. And what's interesting is it looked like they were going to die. They started to remove some of the more prominent passengers from the ship, some of the missionaries, you know, who had to be saved from the disaster so they could do other things. But he stayed there, and he said, quote, "God will not allow me to save myself by leaving my poor brothers to lose not only the life of the body, but also that of the soul, which is eternal." So these were people who he had not yet had the chance to baptize, who he had started to instruct. I mean, if anyone could get a baptism of desire, it would be these people. But he stayed there because he believed they would be lost. Obviously, he didn't believe that they could be saved by baptism of desire. So it's just another interesting example from the life of a saint.